This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Most of our staff is working at home now, and I've started broadcasting from home. So if I sound slightly different, that's the acoustics of my living room. And if you hear a loud meow, that's our cat, Rowdy. My first guest is Octavia Spencer. She won an Oscar for her first big film role in The Help, playing a maid in Mississippi in 1963. She was nominated for an Oscar for her role in Hidden Figures as the head of a unit of African-American female mathematicians doing calculations for NASA to help launch the first Americans into orbit. She also received an Oscar nomination for her performance in The Shape of Water. That film won an Oscar for Best Picture. Now she's starring in the Netflix limited series Self-Made, which is inspired by the life of Madam C.J. Walker, who was born in 1867 on a plantation in Louisiana. After first eking out a living washing clothes for other families, she became a successful businesswoman selling hair products for black women. Eventually, she became the first self-made female millionaire. In the Netflix series, Octavia Spencer plays Madam C.J. Walker. In the first episode, when she's still working as a laundress, she's feeling ugly because her hair is falling out. Her husband has told her she looks like a mangy dog. She tries a hair product that claims to restore lost hair, and it works. Soon she starts selling her own version of the product to poor working women like her. Here she is at an open market, trying to sell her product to a crowd of women.
Sisters, let's talk about hair. Hair can be freedom or bondage. The choice is yours. Want a better station in life? Need to make more money? Come on. Let me show you how.
Hey, what's she talking about?
I had a Cain versus Abel relationship with my hair. Bet some of y'all do too, huh? See, I was born free 2 years after emancipation. Was orphaned by 7. Married at 14, pregnant at 15, widowed by 20. Had to fend for myself and my baby girl. Only work I could find was in the fields or as a washerwoman. Didn't have time to take care of my hair. I know you know what I mean. Hard work on the farm, ain't it?
Wanted to work at the new hotel, but they say I ain't got the right look.
How many of y'all know what she's talking about?
Yes, indeed.
Put us down, don't give us nothing. Tell us we're ugly, make us feel ugly. I tell you what, you come by my salon, I'll do your hair for free.
You got yourself a deal.
Bet you some of y'all are wondering why I would do something for nothing. Because I know how hard it is to care for our hair. I know what it's like to not have running water or products made for us. But most important, I know if she look good, we all look good. If you look respectable, we all look respectable. Everything we do as Negroes reflects back on us. So if I can help one person, I'm lifting us all up. Wonderful hair grower gives me the confidence every day to beat the enemy, slay the demon, fight the good fight as a colored woman in America. Wonderful hair leads to wonderful opportunities. You hear me? Did you hear me?
Octavia Spencer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk a little bit about Madam C.J. Walker's importance in American history?
I can. I can tell you that Madam C.J. was a standard bearer in our household that my mother used to inspire my siblings and myself to strive to be the best that we could be. And so I've always known her story. But what's interesting is her legacy is known in African-American culture, but not really by the masses. And she built an empire for hair care for women of color, black women, actually. And she was the first self-made female millionaire in this country, and the fact that her story isn't known by the masses, I think it's time that we we tell it.
Did your mother use Madam C.J. Walker's hair products?
No. I don't even know if they were still around then. She, basically, we had nothing. And Madam C.J. was born, you know, humbly as well. And she was a woman of purpose. And that's what my mother used to motivate us to be the best that we can be, to reach our potential. And so I've always known about her, and I've always felt that her story was germane to who I am as a Black woman.
So if she not only did hair growth products, she did other hair products. I think she made hair straighteners and cosmetics for African-American women. And so like when you got to Hollywood, did you feel like that was still an issue, having good hair products for Black women, getting good makeup on sets, getting good lighting from in the movies if you have dark skin?
Absolutely. I remember one of the first jobs I had, you go to set and expect to be made up, and there was no makeup for me. And from then on, I always carry my own makeup, but I don't have to now, but I definitely carry my own makeup to sets. And yes, it is still pervasive that women of color have to have someone who knows how to light them. It's something that we struggle with within the profession.
Madam C.J. Walker, as we heard, describes her as having had a Cain versus Abel relationship with her hair. Did you ever struggle with your hair? And did that affect your feelings about your chances of becoming an actress?
No, my mother, I grew up in a household there's six girls and one boy. So my mom, I used to love to watch her wash and style my sister's hair. And so she taught me how to do that. I didn't have a Cain and Abel relationship with my hair. I do now because I'm so used to other people doing it.
But yeah.
But I didn't back then.
So you are in the amazing position of having your first big role, win you an Oscar for Best Supporting in The Help, which for listeners who haven't seen it, is from the point of view of a white journalist writing a book about a couple of African-American women in the South working as maids for wealthy white women. It was based on a novel by a friend of yours, Catherine Stockett, who told you, you played one of the maids, and she told you that this character was based in part on you, not on your work, but on what? On what aspects of you did she draw?
Well, I didn't know Catherine. She was actually very good friends with Tate Taylor, the director and writer of The Help. And I had met her once, and it was while we were in New Orleans, and it was summer, and I was on a diet, which those two things really didn't bode well for Tate, because we were doing some sort of tour, and it was hot in August. And so I was actually very haughty. And I think as she was basically writing The Help, she really didn't have a grasp of who Minnie was, her physicality. And I think she saw this part of my personality that was, I'm the type of person, I'm a straight shooter. And that's kind of, I think, what she drew from. But we didn't really know each other. I think it was just a surface part of what she drew from.
So at what point did you find out that she drew from you to create the role that you ended up playing?
She asked me to read the manuscript. And let me tell you, when you move to Hollywood, everybody has a manuscript, and it's usually terrible.
This is the manuscript for the novel.
For the novel. And she asked me to read it, and I just kept putting it off. And one night I sat down and read it, And well, the way she got me to read it, actually, she said, well, I wrote this and I'd love your opinion. And I loosely based many on you. And of course, my curiosity was piqued. But I just, it was such a thick manuscript. And I'm thinking, if this is terrible, I do not want to waste my time. And of course, it wasn't terrible. I found it very interesting, and I literally read the book in one sitting.
And at what point did it get offered to you as a role in the movie adaptation?
I think Tate had always earmarked that part for me. We had been friends for a long time, and as he was adapting it, you can't make those promises because it's you know, it's up to the studios, whoever the project, whoever produced the project. But he always knew that he wanted me to play that part. And Catherine always knew that she wanted me to play that part. And it was finally offered to me. I think Viola had been attached, and Emma, and then my role, because Tate knew he wanted me, but I don't think the studio knew they wanted me. So
the famous Octavia Spencer. It's like no one knew you.
No one knew me, and there were so many other people that whose name, you know, they did know, but I was certainly grateful that the DreamWorks decided that they wanted me to portray Minnie, but it was because of Tate and Brunson Green, who was also a dear friend, and Catherine and I have, of course, become friends subsequently. But it was the role of a lifetime.
There were decades in Hollywood when the roles that black women got were maids.
Mm-hmm.
And there were very few roles available to African-American women. And that has left some African-American actresses feeling like, I don't want to play a maid. Mm-hmm. So did you have any reservations about that? Now, this is a kind of special case because you like the novel. You were mm-hmm. part of the inspiration for the novel. A dear friend of yours was directing the movie adaptation of the novel. So it's kind of special. But, mm-hmm. you know, did you have any reservations?
Not at all, because I think these women represented real people in our society, people who did noble work. And it was
like your mother, I may add.
Well, like my mother, like so many people, I mean, who facilitate the lives of other people. And I would be remiss if I somehow, you know, looked down or found myself superior in any way. I thought that character was well-rounded. She had a wonderful arc in the book, and I was honored to play her. And I can tell you, I would play a maid. I would play a maid again if the role were better than the character from The Help.
In The Help, like the most famous scene is when you have presented a chocolate pie to the woman whose employee you have been, and in an act of revenge, you bake your excrement into the chocolate pie and tell mm-hmm. her after she's eaten a bunch of it and talked about how delicious it was. And she, of course, is horrified afterwards and runs to the bathroom. I'm wondering if that scene was like nauseating to shoot, even though it was not, there's no excrement for real in mm-hmm. the pie.
It was, I had to be quite honest with you. When I read the book or the manuscript, that was the one thing that I think if Minnie had done that, I don't think that she would have revealed it. I think that would have been her little secret.
Why do you say that? That's a really interesting perception.
Well, because people, I mean, it was during the 60s, and people were killed for far fewer infractions, I think. That was just one of those things. I don't think she would have put her family in jeopardy or her own life in jeopardy. So it was one of the, and I voiced that to Catherine. But that was, it was definitely one of the things that I loved the book, but that was the one thing that stuck out for me. But actually filming it with Bryce, I mean, Bryce is an amazing actress, and we had so much fun with Sissy, who, you know, one of my favorite actresses of all time.
Sissy Spacek,
we had a lot of fun shooting the scenes.
So, how did it feel to you when your suggestion that Minnie would not have done this was rejected?
You know, I don't know that it was rejected. I mean, I had an opinion, and
I guess what I'm asking is, you had to play something that you didn't believe in.
Well, I guess I didn't feel one way or the other. I voiced my opinion about it, and you know, it's interesting, but it was the one thing that I did have reservations about.
You grew up in Montgomery, Alabama. And can I ask what year you were born?
No.
Okay.
I'll say 1975.
Ish.
We'll say around in that
okay,
time.
Ish. Okay. Okay. So what were the schools like when you were going to school? And were there books that you read in your formative years that were very influential for you?
Well, I actually was dyslexic, or am dyslexic, and I had just a love-hate relationship with reading, and it was my first grade teacher who, actually my second grade teacher, who really changed my reading career, because she introduced me to mysteries and the Hardy Boys and Encyclopedia Brown. But I was actually Encyclopedia Brown, because at the end of the Encyclopedia Brown books, you would always have the clues. And the way she kept me engaged with the narrative, she would always say, you have to pay attention to everything, because you don't know what is going to be a clue. So my deductive reasoning skills were developed reading mysteries, and I now have a great affinity for mysteries, and it was because of my second grade teacher, Miss Bradford.
That's such a great story. You know, I've spoken to several actors who have dyslexia, and I always wonder, like, how do you manage to memorize your lines when you have dyslexia?
Well, I'm auditorily inclined, and so I record all of the other characters in the scene, and I record all of their lines and leave space for mine, and that's what I do all day, walk around. I walk around and hear my own voice cues with their lines. So it's basically, I
with the script in front of you so that you could read them?
Yeah, if I go up on a line, yes. I always refer back to the script.
Got it. So you're walking around with the script in your hand, ready to fill in the blanks and correct yourself if necessary.
Exactly, yeah. it's my routine.
So as I hear you talk now, I'm not hearing a Southern accent. I've heard you with Southern accents in some of your roles. Did you have an accent when you went to Hollywood? Is that something that you lost, or that you never had, but that you knew well enough so that you could call on it as needed for performances?
Well, one of the ways that I paid for college was through oration and speech competitions. And that's one of the things that you do. You lose your accent. And only for me, I lost my accent only to find it again in Hollywood. I mean, the only people I know, the only women I knew growing up were Southern women. So most of the characters I play will likely be Southern if they're from a certain class. If, you know, so it's I pick it up, I lose it. And if I'm around Southern people, it definitely comes back quite easily.
So how did oration speech competitions pay for your college?
There were monetary prizes for a few that you would enter. It wasn't a great deal of money, but for me, there were scholarships involved, but small monetary, and you piece them together to help pay for college. At least that was my way.
So what are some of the topics that you had to orate about?
Oh, man, I I can't even remember. I think, actually, you know, I remember excellence, black excellence. I definitely remember one that was about black excellence.
Do you think that the oration speech competitions were helpful in terms of having an acting career? I mean, it's kind of a performance, and you have to do it in front of an audience.
Well, I actually am not the best in front of an audience. I have severe stage fright. So I had to confront that. And public speaking, I always get extremely nervous before any speech that I have to do. And that has not dissipated at all. And so I had to embrace the fact that I will likely always have stage fright.
Octavia Spencer, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on our show.
Oh, this was so fun for me. I'm such a fan. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much. Octavia Spencer stars in the new Netflix limited series Self-Made, inspired by the life of Madam C.J. Walker. The 2017 novel Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng tells the story of the relationship between a black family and a white family in 1990s suburbia. The book has been adapted into a new Hulu series. Our critic at large, John Powers, says it's carried by its stars, Reese Witherspoon and Kerry Washington.
American television spent decades tiptoeing around race, a topic that made advertisers nervous. I can't say exactly when this changed. Maybe somewhere between Obama's re-election and the early Trump presidency. But these days we're seeing an explosion of shows on the subject, including Blackish, Watchmen, Atlanta, Shots Fired, and The People vs. O.J. Simpson. Now comes Little Fires Everywhere, a new 8-part Hulu series adapted from the 2017 bestseller by Celeste Ng. Set during the late 90s in prosperous Shaker Heights, Ohio, this drama uses the fraught encounter between two families, one well-off and white, one bohemian and black, to raise tricky questions about race, social class, and how much we can shape life to our ends. The story begins with type A mother Elena Richardson, that's Reese Witherspoon, watching her family's large home burn down and hearing everyone say that her disaffected daughter Izzy set the fire. To see why this happened, we flash back several months. That's when Elena rents out her family-owned apartment to Mia Warren, a nomadic single mom artist played by Kerry Washington, and her teenage daughter Pearl, that's Lexi Underwood. Bursting with noblesse oblige, Elena is proud to be helping Mia and Pearl make a home in Shaker Heights, a liberal bastion of good schools and seeming racial equality. She wants Mia and Pearl to have a good life like the one she shares with her lawyer husband, played by a genial Joshua Jackson, and their four teenage kids. But life isn't so neat. Even as Pearl begins spending time at the Richardson house, drawn by its unfamiliar air of stability, the rebellious Izzy gravitates to the spiky Mia, whose art strives to show people as they really are, not as they want to be seen. The wary Mia neither likes nor trusts Elena, whom she finds complacent. She's unhappy that Pearl is being pulled into the Richardson family orbit, believing they're both spoiling and using her daughter. To keep an eye on this, she accepts Elena's cringeworthy offer to do domestic work around their house. Naturally, their relationship is strained, as you can hear when Elena bursts in on Mia unannounced with a problem.
Is something burning? Oh, sorry, I knocked. Can I help you? Yes, I forgot to give you the keys to the house and money for the groceries, okay? The place looks great. Actually, the reason that I came by was because I called the person that you listed as your previous landlord, and strangely, he didn't seem to know you.
Huh. Well, the numbers must have gotten mixed up.
Well, I would really appreciate if you could get me the unmixed up numbers.
Yeah, no problem.
Wonderful. Well, I'll let you get back to work.
Okay.
Oh, I was thinking brisket tonight. It's just easy. I'll see you later.
Little Fires Everywhere is being compared to Big Little Lies, another Witherspoon-led adaptation about women in a middle-class Eden. But it lacks that earlier series' fizzy brio. Instead, it rolls out an overstuffed plot involving dark secrets, teen romance, homophobic bullying, and unwanted pregnancy. Not to mention a custody battle between a Chinese immigrant who abandoned her baby girl and Elena's friend who adopted her. Little Fires Everywhere. For all this stuff, the show hits its peak in the face-offs between Mia and Elena. Their vastly different experiences have given them almost opposed visions of the world, visions that, and here they're quite alike, they tend to impose on those around them. Elena is a true child of Shaker Heights, who raises her kids to believe that the world will be orderly and benevolent if, as she puts it, you make good choices. For Mia, such philosophy reeks of white privilege. You didn't make good choices, she tells Elena. You had good choices. A wounded loner, she teaches her daughter that if she doesn't stand up for herself, nobody will. No actress is better at self-deceiving entitlement than Witherspoon, who shows us how Elena's chirpy control freak propriety lets her ignore things in the world and herself that she doesn't want to deal with. If Elena doesn't see enough, Washington plays Mia as a woman who may see too much. She edges toward extremes, from tremulous vulnerability to obvious faux politeness to a furious sense of righteousness. We believe that Washington's Mia could have actually made the art that we see, which is stark, eerie, and confrontational. One would never use these same words to describe Little Fires Everywhere. When they first move into their apartment, Pearl is reading the history of Shaker Heights and learns that it's a town, and I quote, built on the principle that things can and should be built to avoid uncertainty and disaster. Little Fires Everywhere seems to have been made in the same spirit. Highly watchable yet staid, it's the kind of classy, well-meaning show that you can imagine Elena calling thought-provoking and Mia turning off.
Critic at large John Powers reviewed the new Hulu series, Little Fires Everywhere. And my guest Yannick Nezet-Séguin can't do his job, which is conducting two of the world's great music institutions, the Philadelphia Orchestra and the Metropolitan Opera. But I'm pleased to say he's going to spend some time with us. Last week, after the orchestra learned that it would have to cancel performances until at least April 11th, the orchestra decided to go ahead with a final performance, live-streamed, in front of an empty concert hall. Yannick conducted the orchestra in a performance of Beethoven's 5th and 6th symphonies. If you want to watch that performance, it's streaming on the Philadelphia Orchestra website and on YouTube. And thanks to the generosity of the orchestra and in collaboration with WHYY, the full concert will be available to watch on the PBS video app and on WHYY.org. And now that the Metropolitan Opera has canceled performances, they're streaming an encore performance of an opera every day on their website, free for everyone. Like most of us, Yannick can't do what he typically does, but one of the things he can do is talk with us about music he thinks resonates in this moment. Yannick Nezet-Séguin, welcome back to Fresh Air. Thank you for taking the time to do this. How are you?
Well, I consider myself lucky because I'm healthy. Everyone around me is healthy. I am with my family here in Montreal, and I came back here right after my last performance in Philadelphia on last Thursday. And yes, I think, you know, of course, we are living unprecedented times, but relatively speaking, I think we have to count our blessings. And I'm definitely, you know, fit to try and face these new challenges ahead of us.
So I love what the Philadelphia Orchestra and the Metropolitan Opera and probably a lot of other places are doing too, which is, since you can't perform in front of live audiences, you're making performances available to the public through broadcast or streaming. So let's start by talking about the Philadelphia Orchestra, the last time you conducted it. And what you did was you conducted the orchestra in front of basically an empty hall so that it could be broadcast on the classical music station in Philadelphia and then also televised on Channel 12, the TV sister station of WHYY Radio, where Fresh Air is produced. And so what was it like for you to conduct in front of an empty hall, knowing this wasn't a rehearsal, this was the real thing, even though there was nobody there?
Yeah, this is, of course, this was one of the most memorable for good and not so good reasons, of course, because it's sad circumstances, but yet it became a memorable event and experience for all of us on the stage to perform in front of an empty hall. Now, we're communicators, musicians. That's why we do this. Some of what we do is very lonely because when we study scores or when we practice our instrument, it's one-on-one, you know, not even. It's one and the instrument or the score. But all of this is ultimately to share and to have all of a sudden the component of having an audience, so someone who can react immediately, physically, in the same space as we are, to what we do is really unsettling. And immediately, I think for all the musicians and myself, we realized that we were missing this very important part of what we do. And if there's something that even just a few days without being able to perform for audiences, and also when I talk to audience members, you know, by phone or communicate with them through social media, I think that the live experience, already we miss it, and we hopefully, when this is all over, we can resume our live offering with a renewed sense of how important it is for us all to feel like a community.
Was it acoustically different for you to record in an empty hall?
We know our empty hall by rehearsing in it. So it was interesting to see that even though we were wearing concert dress and in concert mode, we felt the same acoustics at the Kimmel Center at Verizon Hall than what we normally hear when it's a rehearsal. So that was not unsettling. What was unsettling was to finish these pieces and have complete silence.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that, of course.
Yeah, that was very, very unsettling. Mm-hmm. And actually quite moving. For some musicians, it was even, you know, they had tears in their eyes because that there was a feeling of emptiness that was, also challenging in a way. But that all made us realize how much we need the audience to bounce our energy back. And that's something essential for the live experience of music. But music can also live otherwise than just live. So that is, I think there's a lot to reflect, and I think it's going to take us a few months to also understand exactly all those differences between the being live with an audience and knowing that there's an audience, of course, but just not having them as part of the experience immediately physically.
Was last Thursday night the first time you used wipes on your baton?
Definitely the first time I used wipes, yes. And we also had to think of the entire decorum of the concert, you know, all the ritual things that we normally do, which is, for example, when I come in, before and after the performance, when I go on stage, I have to shake the hand of the concertmaster But now we had to reflect, you know, of course we can't shake hands. So we decided to opt for a kind of a salute, which is very respectful, which is more a Japanese greeting. And so there's no physical contact, but yet there's an acknowledgement. And, you know, all these little things that we take for granted and that change our daily life for the moment.
So you conducted Beethoven's fifth and sixth, your last performance with the Philadelphia Orchestra before having to shut down. Did the music have different meaning for you in the moment, and did you invest a different meaning in it?
We always planned these concerts to be the start of a Beethoven cycle. So this is the 250th anniversary of Beethoven, and so his music is celebrated all over the world, and we've been planning this great cycle, full cycle in Philadelphia that was supposed to go also to Carnegie Hall, which all of this, of course, is now canceled. I was personally to also go to Europe next month to perform and record those symphonies by Beethoven with a different orchestra, the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. Now, this, of course, is still uncertain. So then when this situation happened, we did not change the program. This is what we were rehearsing and planning on playing. And it's, I don't know, I don't want to read signs of any kind, but the opportunity to connect to our audience in such a moment of shock in the world where all of this is happening and we can't access the concert hall, but having it with Beethoven, who's, you know, whose music is probably the most popular or best known in the symphonic world, and his fifth symphony is the representation of destiny and the humankind overcoming its own destiny, and the Pastoral Symphony, which is all about nature and how to reconnect with nature and nature as a provider and a source of inspiration and hope. We honestly could not have chosen a better program for this, but this is what we had to play. And every musician of the orchestra have played these symphonies countless times, and myself included, I've of course conducted these symphonies so often, but there was indeed a sense of reconnecting to the purpose of what Beethoven wanted to tell us through these symphonies. And Beethoven was a very socially engaged composer in his time, was very had great opinions politically, opinions about also how human nature should take charge of their own destiny and responsibility and their own place in the world. He also, because he was suffering from hearing loss as a composer, as we all know, he had to reflect on the struggle and how to live with a disease. So there's a lot in his music that is still so relevant as a society, and that's really, I think, meaningful and rich when we have to celebrate something that brings the world together.
So Beethoven's most famous passage, probably from Beethoven's Fifth, is bum, 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 bum. So, like, when you play that Thursday night, you know, a passage that so many people have heard so many times, what did it mean to you?
My own vision of this famous motifs about, you know, famous amongst famous, it's, you know, those four notes, is that it's something that's relentless and breathless, and it's actually Beethoven struggling, and it's Beethoven not knowing where this is all going until he finds the solution some 30 minutes later with the last movement, which is in C major. And this is normally my interpretation of it. And of course, with the circumstances, it became even more relentless, even more breathless. I have to congratulate, of course, all the musicians of the orchestra for being so focused in sharing their emotions that moment, even though there was no audience. And I believe that at that point it was quite clear for all of us that we, it might be the last notes we played together for some weeks or months. And this definitely helped inform the performance or charge it with, I wouldn't say even so a fresh vision, but more an emotional content that's just different than any normal. But by the way, there should never be a normal. You know, there should never be in music any sense of routine or something that's just the way it has always been for the sake of it. And but this is why we play music, is to get these emotions, which are hard to put in words. We can actually express them and have hopefully some people inspired in a kind of cathartic way by listening to it.
So let's hear that passage from Beethoven's Fifth that we were just talking about. And this is my guest, Yannick Nezet-Séguin, conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra last Thursday night with no audience in front of an empty hall. So that was my guest, Yannick Nezet-Séguin, conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra last Thursday before an empty hall because audiences were already banned. I listen to a lot of jazz, and a lot of it dates back to like the 1920s that I listened to. And I think about how that music has endured for decades. When I go to the opera, I think of how some of the operas that I'm seeing have endured for centuries. They've endured through wars and world wars. They've endured through epidemics and through the 1918 flu pandemic. Do you think about that a lot, about how the music that you conduct a lot of new work too, but the earlier work that you conduct, that this is music that has endured and given people like joy and comfort and connection for so long, and it ties us to centuries of people who lived before us and who have endured their suffering too.
This is so well said, Terry. I think, you know, what you just said is exactly why we do what we do. This music is not called classical for nothing. It's because it becomes a classic because we actually connect through our being and our history and our aspirations collectively as a society, but also individually, through these masterpieces, because they have an endless power of regenerating our philosophy or our hope in life. And yes, I do think about this a lot, especially not only that they have endured these terrible moments in life, but I think this is where precisely that art has been able to give comfort, to give hope, to give guidance, to give a moment to breathe, something to think, and now is no exception. I think this is where, and it feels strange because we can't give it live, but it's not the first time in history that also live performances are not possible. So we have this advantage to actually be able to share differently. And now what I see, what I'm seeing all over the world happening, and definitely this is what we are doing in Philadelphia, in Montreal, and New York, is several initiatives about what can we do even from our living room to bring it to the people, what the musicians can do as chamber music, just a very small group in the living room, or some Q&As, some lessons online, some gatherings that are that keep the connection and the communication, because that is the key.
Mihanyk, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us. I wish you well. Please stay well, and your family. I hope your family stays well, your friends, the orchestra members, the members of the Met, your whole musical family. Thank you so much for your time and for your music.
Thank you, Terry. It's always an honor and a pleasure to talk to you, and I also wish you health and also your families and loved ones, but very appreciative that you also take the time to bring this content to the people.
Yannick Nezet-Séguin is the conductor and music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra and the music director of the Metropolitan Opera.